Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
So what's the leftover situation in everyone's house? I'm nearly through with mine.
They lasted about 27 hours in our house.
Wow, really?
We had an immense accomplishment in the leftover department in the Wittes household.
You had none?
No, we basically had no leftovers this wow. Thanksgiving. We made the right amount of food for the meal. It's the first time.
Nobody does that.
We've never done it before.
It defeats the purpose. The purpose of Thanksgiving is leftovers. It's not an accident. You're doing it wrong.
Well, we didn't have a turkey, which I think helps a lot. There's no such thing as a
You know what?
Turkey.
We didn't either, and I don't think we're ever going back. My husband did a porchetta instead.
Oh my
and
God!
It was a hit, and no one really likes turkey. And I think turkeys are done.
Ben, you like turkey like me?
I do. And in this case, we didn't make a turkey simply because we couldn't get our hands on a kosher turkey without going through crazy contortions. And so we just did something else. But the result was that we didn't have leftovers. And I have to say, it was kind of fabulous.
I think you've all done it very poorly.
Un-American.
Can't believe I'm the most conservative one on this podcast. Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the You Get a Pardon and You Get a Pardon edition. I'm Shane Harris. You don't get a turkey if you go to Ben's house, apparently, but you might get a pardon.
Everybody gets a pardon.
Maybe Oprah needs a pardon.
For what?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like everyone's getting pardons these days, just in case.
Maybe she's the one who attempted to do a pardon for
Bri. She's a mystery pardon. Oh my God.
She didn't even need it. She just wanted it for fun.
There's a new piece of legal scholarship out suggesting that the reason that the president can't self-pardon is the word grant in the Constitution, that grant means you have to give it to somebody else. Oh. And so I think it's Oprah handing out pardons. You get one and you get one and you get one. She's out there granting pardons.
That could, well, I mean, maybe. Maybe she should be president. She should try it. I am here in the remote jungle studio with my good friends, Ben Wittes, Tamara Kaufman Wittes, and Susan Hennessy, and our very special guest this week, live from Israel, folks. It's our friend, Noah Ephron of the Promised Podcast. Hey, Noah.
Hey, it's great to be here. I'm so happy.
We're so happy you're here, too. Folks who've listened to the podcast before have heard us talk about Noah's great podcast, and we're very psyched to have you. I think this might be our first international podcast. Is this possible?
We had Sophia in from China, didn't we?
Oh, that's true.
And we have had Ben join from Israel before.
Oh, that's true. Oh, I'm sorry. No, you're not even the first person from Israel on the podcast.
But this is our very first Promise Podcast Rational Security log rolling edition.
That's right. That's right. The logs have merged. It's a happy union of logs. Welcome back, everybody, from the holiday. Hope you all had a good one. There was some news while we were gone, and we're going to get right to it.
A little bit.
A little bit. Un poquito, as they say. On the podcast this week, a top Iranian nuclear scientist is assassinated. Everyone gets pardons this Christmas. And the Attorney General takes steps to ensure that the investigation of the Russia probe continues into the Biden administration. That's his own special Christmas gift to all of us. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
The Russia investigation.
It's the probe that keeps on probing.
It will never end.
What would we do if it ever did end?
Oh my God, we have to go back to talking about like hard national security choices.
No, we'd learn new skills like macrame and woodworking. Free time.
Let's start with Iran. The news this week that the man who has been described as the godfather of Iran's nuclear program was gunned down near Tehran last week. an operation that bears what many see as the hallmarks of an Israeli assassination, by Israeli intelligence, I should say, and the government in Iran has attributed this to Israel. There are varying reports of exactly how this went down, including some more dramatic ones involving a possibly remote-controlled machine gun mounted on a car that then self-destructed, and then some like more traditional reports, I guess, of just a straight-up shooting of the scientist. It's not clear what, if any, involvement or knowledge the U.S. had in this, but it may pose some dilemmas, to put it mildly, for the incoming Biden administration, which intends to rejoin the nuclear agreement with Iran that was, of course, forged in the Obama administration, in which the U.S. pulled out of under the Trump administration. So, Noah, let's start with you. Talk to us about how this operation is being reported in the press in Israel, and talk to us about what the reaction has been.
Well, the reaction has been almost entirely positive. It has been a matter in a country that is famous for being conflictual about absolutely everything. It is a matter of very near consensus. It's not entirely consensual. There are a few voices that are saying some of the same criticisms that one hears abroad. A former member of Knesset, Naomi Chazan, from the left-wing Meretz party, and she was the head of the New Israel Fund, wrote an article suggesting that we would gum up our relationship with the incoming Biden administration by virtue of having done this, and that she essentially said that the criticisms that she was hearing from Democrats in the United States are more or less right. That was very nearly a sole voice, the present head of the Meretz party, which is as far left as Jewish parties, at least in the Knesset, go. His name is Nitzan Horowitz, said that while he was very much in favor of the United States reigniting the JCPOA, and he worried about this act, he still did not condemn the attack. And then beyond that, basically wall-to-wall support. So the head of the opposition, Yair Lapid, whose job it is and really just whose goal in life is to wake up each morning and do whatever he can do to topple this government and besmirch Netanyahu in any way possible, even he posted or tweeted support saying that this was absolutely a necessary, justified assassination. That's the exact quote. And that anyone who thought otherwise, like the Europeans, were exhibiting what he called moral bankruptcy and cravenness. And so there is not a single party in the Knesset, including the joint list, the Arab party, none of the left parties condemned it. It seemed to be something that had basically everything that Israelis love. It had derring do, it had fancy technology. It ignored the button-down propriety of the Europeans and Americans. It was a little bit of a finger in people's eyes. And it was an act, some act that seemed perhaps to be increasing Israel's security in the face of a threat from Iran that people take quite seriously. So the JCPOA was never broadly popular here. And I think that people saw this as just something that was a good thing to do. It's a little bit astonishing how utterly depoliticized it is on the Israeli scene. It's just something that pretty much everyone almost axiomatically accepts as having been something that increases our security and therefore is good.
So it sounds like there's not necessarily a reaction to it as in this was urgently necessary, but was something that would have been good to do now or whenever it could have been done, right? I mean, insofar as taking this person out, and I gather that it's being seen as something that will be detrimental to Iran's development of a nuclear weapon.
Absolutely, and absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting things about this is that almost everything that the Netanyahu government now does is subject to the criticism that Prime Minister Netanyahu is doing it just in order to save his political skin. An accusation that is usually right about most of the things he does, and that claim has not been put forth about this at all, which is which is a little bit of an astonishment. So I think that people assume that it was a long time in coming, that, of course, Israel already a decade ago began to assassinate Iranian scientists, including some of the scientists that Fakhrizadeh worked with. And I think that people see it as part of an ongoing policy and a good policy. And they assume, if anything, that this was long in the works before the American election and isn't really intended particularly to scuttle any plans that the Biden administration has to grow closer to Iran. Although I do think that people assume that Netanyahu believes that that's a good side effect of this, and many Israelis agree.
And what do people think, Noah, or what are they saying about whether the U.S. was involved or had some heads up about this? I mean, we don't know the answer to that question here, but I'm curious, do people assume that we must have, or that we were involved, or do they see this as, no, this is something that Israel was perfectly willing and able to do on its own?
Well, Mike Pompeo visited right before this happened, pretty much. And there was a famous photo op of him sipping wine at a vineyard in the occupied territories. And he also, while he was here, met with the head of the Mossad. So one of the waggish reactions that one saw a lot on Twitter just after this was announced was that, I guess, that Pompeo hadn't come here to drink wine at all. I don't think that anybody believes that in any way this was not entirely Israel's initiative, but I think that most people assume that it was done with the knowledge of the Trump administration and the support.
So, Tammy, that kind of leads naturally to the question of, what does this mean for the Biden administration? I mean, we said at the top that President-elect Biden has said that he wants to rejoin the nuclear agreement. I think there's a general assumption that, you know, for obvious reasons, this could complicate that. But how do you think this is going to, in specific ways, prove to be an obstacle for Biden as he pursues that goal? Or is it? Are we misreading it and actually this doesn't have to disrupt his plan?
I don't think it's necessary that it is a disruption. I do think it's interesting that so much of the commentary on both sides of the American political spectrum, and indeed commentary in Israel about critics in America of this assassination, I think it's interesting that all of that is focused on whether Netanyahu and Trump are jamming Biden or corner, you know, putting Biden in a corner or derailing Biden or what have you. I mean, you know, and that's because no matter what the plans, you know, how long planned this was, it is coming in the context of our not quite being out of a very, very polarized electoral season. And so everything is Trump versus Biden. And there are lots of other things, let's be frank, that the Trump administration is doing to try and jam Biden on lots of policy issues and on Iran as well. But I think, you know, Noah is very wise to point to the fact that targeting Iranian nuclear scientists has been a priority for Israeli intelligence for years and years. And this isn't even the first such assassination. And so there's no reason to think that this was done deliberately with that motive of derailing Biden in mind. I think it's more a manifestation of how politicized things are in this country, that's immediately where everybody went and kind of dragged Israel into that argument. Oh, they're helping Trump against Biden. I do think, though, that, you know, if we cast our minds back just to January, when the United States engaged in a targeted assassination of a senior Iranian official, Qasem Soleimani, it was interesting that the fear that manifested in the wake of that, you know, when the Iranians retaliated against our troops in Iraq and over 100 U.S. soldiers were injured, the fear that we might be on the brink of a new war, that was something that affected the right in the United States as much as the left. And to me, that says that Biden actually has room politically to pursue policies toward Iran that are not as confrontational as Trump's. Whether he can actually get into a negotiation with the Iranians about returning to the JCPOA or extending that deal or expanding that deal, I don't think any of that is going to happen immediately, but I do think he's got political space to explore it. I think the real question is whether the Iranians feel the need to retaliate for this assassination in some manner and whether they want to do that while Trump is still president in order to say, like, we're not retaliating against Joe Biden's presidency. We're, you know, retaliating against the Israelis and the Trump administration.
Yeah. And that made me wonder, too. And Noah, maybe you can address this. When the Iranian government was so quick to come out and attribute this to Israel, I think the read, at least here anyway, and probably in Israel too, was, well, now they're going to have to respond to it because they wouldn't come out and attribute it to Israel and then do nothing. Is that your read on it too?
There was a lot of speculation about that. I think that people are saying the Iranians are just hard to read at this particular moment. There is, I think that there is great faith, a little bit surprising actually, when I think about it, in the rationality of the local rationality of the Iranians in dealing with these kinds of things. So from the very start, it seemed quite possible that the Iranians would bide their time and wait for the Biden administration to come in and see whether they could advance negotiations and somehow end the sanctions that are strangling them. But then there were other voices that said, no, they have to respond now. And in the end, people just, I said, I guess with the Iranians, we have to wait and see.
I actually think that one of the choices the Iranians have is, you know, where they want to retaliate. And, you know, we've seen in other instances that they sort of take their time. And but here they have a very strong choice. Are they going to retaliate against, you know, a Western target in the broad sense? Are they going to retaliate against an American target the way they did in January and American targets in Iraq? Or are they going to try and find some way to target Israelis specifically and make clear, you know, try to use this as a message to the Americans, hey, we have an open door to talking to you. We're just mad at Israel. And, you know, I would say that that kind of strategy might not work, you know, because a terrorist attack against Israelis is also going to generate a political reaction in Washington. But if I were the Israeli government or Israeli intelligence, I would be really worried about that. And I would be thinking about Hezbollah. I would be thinking about, you know, some kind of border transgression. And I would also be thinking about, you know, Israelis abroad who might be vulnerable to Iranian-sponsored terrorism in a third country.
To add to that point, you know, one of the calibrations that the Iranians make, and it is not always a distinction that we notice, but it is a distinction of high salience to them, is whether they respond by attacking a military target or a civilian target. They do both, but I do think a response that's directed, say, against U.S. forces in Iraq is a different thing from their point of view than a response that's directed at, for example, Israeli civilian communities in the north of Israel, or in the extreme case that the Iranians have done, Jewish targets, not even Israeli targets, but Jewish targets elsewhere. They were, of course, famously responsible for the Buenos Aires Jewish Community Center attack. And so, you know, all of these things just seem like attacks to us. The different gradations is the response, as Tammy says, against Western targets or Israeli targets specifically, but also, is it a military target or is it a civilian target?
Right. And of course, Israeli embassies have gone on high security alert as well.
Ben, just in the few minutes we have left in this segment, just address, in addition to the policy and the security issues this raises, there's a legal one as well. Is there a way to argue that this killing was legal and justifiable, or is this something else?
I don't think so.
You don't think that it's legal?
Justifiable is a different question, right?
Okay.
I think, but if it's the question of whether it's legal is a simple one, and the evidence that it's a simple one is that the Israelis have never acknowledged these attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists. And one of the reasons for that is that they don't want to have to make a legal argument that these are legitimate targets for targeted killing. And so they retain a certain strategic ambiguity about whether it's them that did it. And one of the reasons for that is so that they don't have to make a legal argument here. Remember, the U.S. view of what is a lawful targeted killing is by international standards quite expansive and to many international organizations, you know, lawless itself. But even in the expansive U.S. view, which the Israeli view is largely congruent with, you're targeting combatant infrastructure or people, that is, people who are themselves part of the command structure of a military, who, depending on context, pose a threat in some degree of imminence or unfolding in character. And so think about the Anwar al-Awlaki, which was highly controversial from a U.S. point of view, but the U.S. contends, and I agree, that it was a lawful strike. Their contention was that he was constantly individually planning attacks, right? Now, this involves a series of civilian scientists. Now, granted, they're civilian scientists who are working on ultimately non-civilian issues, but there is no question that they are individually planning attacks or that they are individually engaged in hostilities directly themselves. And so I just don't know of a coherent legal argument that that would be appropriate. And certainly if somebody walked up in the streets of Tel Aviv to an Israeli nuclear scientist who had worked, say, at Dimona, the nuclear plant at Dimona, where the Israeli nuclear scientists developed their bomb and shot him in the street, the Israeli government position would not be that this was, you know, a lawful military target. So I don't think as a legal matter, it's a close question. And that said, I am pretty sympathetic as a policy matter to the Israeli sense that, hey, they don't have a whole lot of levers to pull here, short of full-fledged warfare, to retard the Iranian nuclear program. So they're not going to forswear the ones that they've got, including ones that are not lawful. And they're just going to handle that by doing it and not acknowledging that they've done it.
Well, speaking of not needing a legal justification, the president has pardoned Michael Flynn. Surprising no one. Was anybody really surprised that the president pardoned Michael Flynn? I'm surprised no. It took this long.
Yeah. And that he pardoned him for like everything, including parking tickets, basically.
Well, there.
Right?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. and we're going to get to some other. There's been a long list of pardons. Right. And
Flynn's pardon is less surprising than the Thanksgiving turkey pardon.
This is more than one turkey, this pardon.
Only a little bit, but still less surprising.
If we're going to get to the other pardons that are being rumored and this fascinating mystery pardon, which we alluded to at the top of the show. But first, let's talk a little bit about Flynn. I think people knew this was coming. I think people assumed that it would be broad, and it is. You know, as Tammy said, it pretty much covers, not just the crime he pleaded guilty to, which, to remind people, was lying to the FBI following his conversations in the transition with the Russian ambassador, but also crimes that he may have committed. I think it pretty much covers, as I read it, anything that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, may have investigated, potentially stuff that he did with Turkey, which we may want to talk about. Susan, let's start with you about this. Did it surprise you that it was this broad? And does the fact that it's this broad signal that the president suspects that Michael Flynn does have some criminal vulnerability, including, plots to kidnap and assassinate or kidnap a Turkish cleric from U.S. soil or any of the shady lobbying that he may have been involved in?
Yeah, I'm not remotely surprised that it's this broad because this is not like a thoughtful pardon, right? So ordinarily, whenever we think about presidential pardons, they're forwarding very, very particular policy goals, messaging goals, forgiving very sort of specific crimes. Trump isn't using the pardon power like any other president has. He's using it for sort of a corrupt and self-serving purpose. And so if you're going to do do that, you throw everything in, right? You aren't sort of careful and narrow and technical sort of in your corruption. So I don't think that it's at all surprising that it happened or that it was sort of extraordinarily broad. That said, it is a very specific form of corruption, and one that I do think there's a little bit of a risk of, well, it's not surprising and therefore it doesn't seem like a huge deal. So I'm not like losing a lot of sleep at night that Michael Flynn isn't, you know, going to spend time in jail. You know, I never thought that that was going to happen, certainly not after sort of the Justice Department's intervention in sort of attempting to withdraw the case. You know, that said, this is clearly the fulfillment of a corrupt bargain, and a corrupt bargain that Mueller sort of danced around in his report. Michael Flynn cooperated, except for he never was willing to say that Donald Trump was the person who directed him to pick up the phone and make this phone call to Sergei Kislyak. The thing that sets off everything else, the thing that implicates the president in all of the other really bad conduct, right? Kind of that link that ends up being kind of a critical deficiency and a reason why Mueller, I think, sort of restrains himself from making sort of more explicit accusations of things like obstruction of justice. And it's just not credible, one, that Michael Flynn wouldn't remember, and two, that Michael Flynn would have been acting of his own volition or at the direction of anybody else. And so we know that the Mueller report describes Trump dangling these pardons. And we've heard the voicemails from Trump's lawyers to Michael Flynn's lawyers, in which they certainly hint at the idea of pardons. And now it's fulfilled. On this critical fact, Michael Flynn kept his mouth shut, and now the president has pardoned him. And that is a use and abuse of the pardon power that I think is genuinely unprecedented in American history. And I spent a lot of time in the past, sort of 2 years thinking about pardons because it's an important part of one of the chapters of Ben in my book. And there are lots of different reasons for pardons. And it's a fascinating, really, really interesting constitutional debate, policy debate. There are lots of reasons for the pardon power, sort of instrumental views that it's really, it's sort of a national security authority. George Washington uses it to pardon people who participated in the Whiskey Rebellion, this idea of sort of needing to quiet, you know, the public temper and move the country forward. There's obviously people who are pardoned as an expression of justice because, you know, an overly rigid criminal justice system itself manifests injustice. And so the ability to sort of to cure these ills. Barack Obama thought a lot about sort of using the pardon as an expression of mercy. People who have actually violated the law and been sentenced for their crimes, you know, forgiveness and a second chance. You know, we have seen sort of, corrupt uses of the pardons, right? Bill Clinton is a famous example, pardoning Mark Rich. But this degree of self-interestedness and this degree of sort of, I think almost sort of criminality on the face of it is, I think, the apex of an assault against this power that has Trump sort of set in motion with his earliest pardons of Joe Arpaio, right? A sense that he was using this power for self-serving purposes, to reward his allies, to reward campaign donors. He dangles it as part of sort of his obstruction of justice scheme. And now I think we are going to see this, a number of pardons. Obviously, already they're discussing pardons for the kids, for Rudy Giuliani, for himself. It's all part of the same rotten thing. And I think the really unfortunate part about it is that the historic issue with pardons in the United States is not that presidents use them too much or too freely, but they don't use them enough. They've sort of developed this process of a pardon attorney to distance themselves from the power. They're really afraid to use it, even in moments in which they should, in which it's a good thing, no matter which sort of policy justification you come down on. And my concern is that this overt corruption is going to sort of set us back into a period of course correction, where we've been moving towards more and more presidential pardons for good public service, public interested reasons. And now presidents are going to clamp back down, and we're going to sort of return to a world of this very sort of stingy, minimal use of the power. And I I think that's sort of, it's a good example of how Trump, it's not just that Trump abuses and erodes his own office, but that he leaves it in worse shape than when it started.
All right. So Susan, you flicked at the reports that there may be preemptive pardons for Rudy, for the kids. I think it's safe to say that we'll table that for another time. I want to spend a little bit of time too in this segment talking about this very strange report that surfaced yesterday, which Ben, I'll come to you first on this. There appears to be some kind of federal investigation into a pardon in exchange for money involving the White House. Should be clear, it's not entirely clear from the single document, which was a memorandum opinion, I think, right, from Judge Howell in the D.C. District Court that was released yesterday. It's not entirely clear that this does definitely involve the Trump White House, but I think it kind of points pretty strongly that it does. And we don't know who the players are who are involved in it and what exactly the alleged crime was. But Ben, talk a little bit about this rather surprising development that's, you know, pointing to a potential bribery for pardon scheme involving the White House and is coming into public view in this moment when, you know, pardons are flying and the president seems to be prepared to basically give them out to all of his friends.
Yeah. So, you know, Susan alludes to the transaction of a pardon in exchange for silence in the case of Flynn as an obstruction of justice, but you can trade a pardon for other things too, including cash. And there's a lot of redactions. The document is mostly redaction, but it does describe clearly a Justice Department investigation of at least three people, maybe more, who are suspected of running some kind of a scheme in which they were planning to, or maybe did, seek to offer a large campaign contribution in exchange for a pardon for one of them. The circumstance becomes public because, and there's some interesting tidbits here, because some of the communications that the Justice Department obtains involving these people might, or some of them claim that they are attorney-client privileged. And so the Justice Department goes to court to verify that it's allowed to look at them, which is how this issue becomes the subject of a court opinion at all. Now, I do think there is a lot of reason to be cautious about this. And the most important is that it is not clear to me that Judge Howell would have made this document public if the investigation were still ongoing. The Justice Department objected to this document becoming public, according to Judge Howell's opinion, because it named unindicted individuals, not because there was a pending investigation that the release of this material would interfere with. And so one possibility is that the investigation is no longer active, and this was something that was examined and not pursued. Another possibility, of course, is that, there is a crime spree going on involving pardons, and some of them are along the lines that Susan described, and some of them are at least contemplated to be a more, why don't we just say a sort of cash-based economy.
And it does raise the question to me, and I don't mean to be glib when I say this, but, you know, why do you need to pay the president to get a pardon? I mean, he's handing them out, it seems, you know, to people who politically been allied with him, you know, who have helped him out, who he thinks have done wrong. Or should we be reading this, again, if it involves, you know, this White House and if it was credible, as the president having set the tone that I am willing to give out pardons for all kinds of reasons. So come bearing gifts if that's what you want.
Yeah. So just to be clear, it is not clear at all from this document that the subjects of the investigation are government officials in the White House or elsewhere. It is possible that what's happening here is somebody goes to prison and he or she and the hench people around him or her are plotting to engage in this cash for pardon scheme. But I could not find anything in the document that suggested that there was an investigation of White House personnel here.
Yeah, I agree with that. And look, I do think that the fact that this was, right, sort of in exchange for a campaign contribution raises the likelihood that the person in question is somebody we've never heard of here. Trump is clearly already thinking about handing out all kinds of self-interested pardons. It's sort of anybody in his orbit. And so the idea that this person felt the need to make it as explicit as saying, I'll do it, you know, I'll make this campaign contribution, I think is potentially a hint that this is an example of sort of outsiders taking advantage of a very clear culture of corruption and people with access to the president being, whether they're government officials or non-government officials, being willing to facilitate that because they themselves are corrupt. I mean, one of the sort of the humorous things about this, and Ben and I were kind of, you know, parsing this document really carefully, you know, trying to sort of suss out hints of who it might be, is that there are so many people in Donald Trump's orbit that are criminals, that like it's actually really difficult to narrow it down. Any other president, you would at least be able to say, well, it's one of what, one or two people? Donald Trump, like there are just so many plausible candidates that like people are trying to say, well, here's the apostrophe, so it ends in an S, and that gets it down to 20 names, and oh, it's five letters. I mean, it's just, it is absurd just the extent of plausible candidates here.
Well, and can we also note that, you know, Trump's campaign did not do well fundraising this year, and he needs to raise more money before he leaves the presidency to retire debts and to give himself a war chest for 2024, if that's what he wants to do. And so not only has he set a tone of transactionalism, corrupt transactionalism here, but he has a really strong incentive to accept all offers.
Well, I don't think I need to be pardoned for anything, but, you know, I would love to know the going rate. So,
Yes. Well, the rate depends on the offense, doesn't it?
It's a going on a business sale, guys. So
it's a two for one pardon. It's a clearance model. So it's clearance sale. So you can't actually take the pardon back if you're not happy with it. You have to take it off the floor in its current condition. Oh, lordy, lordy. Well, speaking of things that will apparently never leave us, including Donald Trump, the attorney general has decided that John Durham, the U.S. attorney in Connecticut, who has been investigating the investigators, as we've talked about on the podcast before, will get to continue his work. And he has been magically converted from a U.S. attorney into a special counsel. Or maybe he's a U.S. attorney while he's a special counsel. Maybe
he's both right now.
He gets to wear two hats. So John Durham got a new hat for Christmas. Ben, this was revealed yesterday, Tuesday, right, in a interview that the attorney general did with the Associated Press, in which he said, oh, by the way, we found no evidence of fraud in the election that would change the results, announcing that he had given this this new authority to John Durham, that he did it actually before the election, which was notable, and it's only being revealed now. And there were reasons, I think, that he gave for that, which seemed, I thought, actually pretty plausible insofar as he didn't want to be seen as interfering in the election. But essentially what this seems to mean is that John Durham doesn't close up shop at the end of the administration and that he keeps going into the future. So I guess from its face, one question I want to have for you is to start is, does this special counsel designation seem legitimate? I mean, as I understand it, the special counsel regulations say this person has to come from outside of government, but John Durham, of course, is in government. He is a federal prosecutor, a U.S. attorney, but does Attorney General Barr have the authority to do this anyway? So that's number one. And then let's get to the question of why Barr is doing this, and should the Biden administration just torpedo that order and send Durham on his way? But start with the actual, the legality of it, if I can use that phrase.
Yeah, so this is more complicated than the question legally of assassinating Israeli nuclear scientists. So, first of all, don't ever forget that Bill Barr is smart. And, you know, people forget that because people are so angry at him and hate him so much. But he's a very smart man, and this was done in an extremely clever way. And the more time I spend studying it, the more clever it seems to me. So, first of all, the formal mechanism by which he appointed Durham is exactly the same as the formal mechanism by which Rod Rosenstein appointed Bob Mueller himself. And so what he did was he did not use the regulation, the special counsel regulation, to do the appointment, because the special counsel regulation wouldn't allow him to do this appointment. He instead used a general set of statutory authorities, and then he applied the rules of the regulation, which include the rule that says you can't fire him except for cause. Now, if you go back to the Mueller appointment order, the structure of the appointment is exactly the same. And so Bill Barr gets to say, I did exactly what Mueller, I gave him exactly the same appointment structure that Mueller had, which of course makes it hard for people who supported the Mueller investigation and thought it would be very improper to fire Bob Mueller to object to this. So that's clever thing number one. Clever thing number two is the scope of the investigative mandate, which is huge. We talk about the scope of the mandate for the pardon of Flynn, but basically Bill Barr wrote a mandate for John Durham here that's you have a jurisdiction over any illegality committed ever in the FBI investigation, the Crossfire Hurricane investigation, or the Mueller investigation. So he's effectively created a special counsel, I think the first time we've ever had this, to investigate another special counsel. And then there's clever thing number three, which is it's totally unclear what Durham is investigating. So Durham was set up as a review, administrative review. He then became a criminal investigation because this guy, this FBI lawyer, Kevin Kleinsmith, falsified a document. But it is not clear at all what he is investigating at this point, what the purported illegalities that he's looking at is. And so what Bill Barr has effectively saddled the new administration with is a giant, sweeping mandate, jurisdictional mandate, for a prosecutor that they can't easily fire. Now, are there ways around it? Yes, there are ways around it. They are ways around it that would be very difficult politically to execute. And so I think this is an example of Bill Barr really putting one over on his successor in a fashion that's going to be difficult for the next attorney general to manage. And, you know, how he or she is going to do that is going to be one of the early questions that the Biden administration Justice Department is going to face. It's a dirty trick. It's really nasty. And I think it's really smart.
Yeah, so I agree with all of that, except for I think Barr made a few big errors, or potentially a few big errors, that like it's a clever little scheme, but I think it might end up being sort of too cute by half at the end. So the first is that he selected Durham to play this role. John Durham is a political appointee. He is currently the U.S. attorney. And the reason why, even though this particular part of the regs he didn't apply, Bill Barr didn't apply, but the reason why the regs say somebody out of government is because the special counsel is supposed to be a non-political actor. It is supposed to be someone with a reputation, you know, for sort of fair-mindedness and integrity. These regs are not designed so that you can convert a political appointee, allow them to continue politically motivated investigations that are going to endure into your successor's administration. So sort of as a threshold matter, I don't think there's really all that much to stop the new attorney general from coming in And even if they decide not to, you know, to allow the investigation to continue, to say, John Durham is not an appropriate person to be conducting this investigation just by virtue of having been a political appointee at the time. I mean, that's not even a close call. Now, if the investigation is close to being wrapped up, you know, there may be some sort of, it may be easier to just let it, run its course. But I think that's sort of, that's the first thing of, I wonder if that'll end up being a serious error. The second one is, I think Ben, you know, is right. There are two possibilities here. One is there's some kind of live criminal investigation that just isn't clear to us at the, you know, from the outside. There's actually some kind of issue, in which case there is 0% chance that a new attorney general comes in and attempts to kill an ongoing criminal inquiry. This is right. Like, this is the last thing that a new AG who has this incredibly difficult task of sort of restoring these norms at DOJ is going to want to saddle themselves with, you know, in order to help out people who were, you know, sort of attached to the prior administration, people that they could sort of easily cut loose. So I think Bill Barr is assuming, I guess on one set of facts, is assuming everybody is as corrupt and unprincipled as he is. And I don't know who the new AG will be, but I'm pretty sure that they'll be have more integrity and principle than Bill Barr does, in which case appointing Durham special counsel is obnoxious. But I actually don't think it's significant or in terms of changing the outcome at all. The other possibility is that the Durham investigation is what it appears to be from the outside, which is an investigation that was couched as an administrative review because it was really sort of a fishing trip in search of a criminal predicate. They didn't have a criminal predicate. You aren't allowed to investigate things that don't have criminal predicates. And so by doing this admin review, they were looking. They found this Kleinsmith thing. Okay, they were able to charge that. That made it a criminal investigation. Now they're looking. And what this really is about is an effort by Barr to, one, let an illegitimate investigation continue, make it more difficult for the AG to shut down an investigation that should be properly shut down. And two, is supposed to be an end run around which the Justice Department describes non-criminal conduct, right? So a byproduct of the Mueller investigation, which was ultimately a criminal investigation, was that he released this report. And this report that described lots of conduct by U.S. citizens who weren't actually charged with crimes. That's not something the Justice Department usually does. That's something the Justice Department is really, really hesitant to do. And for good reason. That doesn't mean that it was improper in the Mueller report circumstances, but it's supposed to be unusual. And this looks a lot like Bill Barr attempting to both let sort of an illegitimate investigation persist and also find a way to force the Justice Department's hand in releasing all of this information that in the ordinary course of things, it wouldn't release. I agree with Ben, though. It does. It is clever in the sense that it does really put the new attorney general in a difficult position as of day one. And that person, I think, is going to face a choice. At the threshold, they're going to have to figure out, all right, is this a legit investigation or not? If it is a legit investigation, then I think they have no choice but to let it continue. But if it's not a legitimate investigation, it's going to be a really difficult choice. Do you allow it to continue and just kind of burn itself out and roll your eyes and say, okay, fine, you know, I guess we won't fire John Durham and this report will come out and everybody will look sort of silly at the end? Or instead, does the AG really make the case to the public and say, look, we're shutting this down because it violates sort of basic principles of the Department of Justice and of reasons for investigations? And that Bill Barr's fundamental miscalculation is that he's assuming that the label of special counsel was what prevented Trump and Barr himself from being able to get rid of Mueller, you know, without paying too high of a political price. But the reality is it wasn't the label or being called a special counsel. It was the fact that there was clearly a real matter to be investigated. And so that the public is going to see right through this if they say, look, there's nothing here, and that they ultimately can dismiss Durham and shut this investigation down and not pay a political price because the public understands that it's a legitimate thing to do.
Tammy, you had a question.
Yeah, I mean, everything that Susan just said to me reinforces that it's less about whether there's a predicate for the investigation that the public understands, and it's more about the character of the person who has the authority to do the investigation. The reason that Trump and everyone had trouble firing Mueller is because Mueller's Mueller. And because he's Mr. Squeaky Clean and starched white shirt, and he was doing everything by the book. And so my question, Ben, I guess, is about Durham. Susan raised the possibility that Barr assumes that everybody inside the intelligence community and the FBI is as corrupt as he is. I guess my question is, what do we know about Durham's own inclinations? And, you know, is he going to do this in a straight arrow way, or is he going to do a Ken Starr and turn it into a fishing expedition?
So the signals on that score are mixed. I mean, Durham has a decent reputation as a federal prosecutor. He's been turned to in the past for kind of high profile national security matters that needed to be reviewed from outside main justice. He's not one of the stars of the federal prosecution system, but he was not certainly not thought of as a raging partisan. That was the background. His behavior during this episode has been exceedingly peculiar from the beginning. He, you know, met with Barr repeatedly and seemed to become kind of an agent of Barr's conspiracy theories. He seemed to be for a while reviewing stuff far outside the Justice Department that was, you know, basically the intelligence community's assessment of Russian interference. And he made these very peculiar public statements at the time of the Inspector General's report that seemed like a comment on his own pending investigation. So I think his conduct in this matter has been far from exemplary, and it does raise a question about his impartiality. And yeah, I think that's like, I think you can argue it both ways, but I don't trust him at this point.
All right, let's move on to object lessons. Noah, you are our special guest, so I think you should get to go first since you're the guest.
Terrific, thank you. See, all this time, I've been listening since the very beginning of this podcast. I love this podcast. You're so wonderful. But all this time, I thought you were saying abject lessons, and I have all sorts of examples of objection. It's kind of the story of my life. It's kind of my brand.
You are such a professor.
I've got this. I was telling Tammy about it before. At the very beginning of March, the artist Jeff Koons shipped to Tel Aviv maybe 15 huge sculptures, his orange balloon dog, his balloon Venus, his incredible Hulk. You may have seen these when they were at the MoMA last year. And he did this for an exhibit that was planned to open on March 20th, which was exactly a week after Purim, exactly when the coronavirus really hit Israel. And Koons was supposed to come to Israel for the very first time for the opening, which of course never happened. And the museum closed before the exhibit ever opened. So the exhibit was set up in March, but it remained completely unseen in the big cavernous halls of the Tel Aviv Museum of Art until yesterday, when the museum reopened for just a few people at a time. And you got the tickets in advance on the internet for a particular time. And my Susan and I got tickets, and we biked over and we nosed around the museum, which was kind of like going back to summer camp after a long year away. It was very, very wonderful just to be in the museum. And when we got to the Koons, we walked in right behind a family of four, a mom and a dad and a toddler in a stroller, and maybe a five-year-old girl. And when we walked in, we were right behind her. And she looked over and she bounded over to the 8-foot-high, seemingly inflatable plastic, though in fact bronze, fashioned to look like polyvinyl chloride, incredible Hulk, who has a huge boulder of marble on his shoulder. And so I'm watching this kid watch this sculpture, and her eyes went so wide and her mouth was slack. And you could see at that moment, it was all starting up again. You could see it all happening, like the mind-blowingness of a world that was unfolding for the very first time to a kid. And then it made me think, and this is not some Eddie Haskell-y kind of suck up a tude. It made me think about the show that you posted last week, that Deer in a Headlights, Trump's Just Been Elected show, which was so odd and unnerving, and the contrast between that show and now. And it made me think that things still kind of suck, but the world, if the world in front of this incredible Hulk, 8 feet incredible Hulk, the world is unfolding again. It's like what Shelley said, that if winter comes, can spring be far behind? And I know it because I have now seen an 8 foot incredible Hulk, and I've seen the kids seeing it for the first time. And it just feels like the world is unfolding. And I got to be on Rational Security. So obviously we're living in a time of miracles and wonders.
I love that. I love that. That is the best light at the end of the tunnel that I think I've heard in a while. Vaccines are pretty good too, but that's pretty awesome. I'm going to go next because mine is sort of like sculpture adjacent, I guess. If you know me, and if you listen to this podcast, you do, then you obviously know what my object is going to be this week. I'm talking about the monolith, everybody.
Which you think came from the aliens, right? Am I right?
I mean,
Shane put it there.
Listen. I mean, now if I had put it there, that would have figured out maybe a different kind of rollout than just having. Are they sheep counters or sheep herders? I think they're sheep counters. They're not even sheep herders who stumbled upon this metallic. It's not really a monolith. People want to say fine, whatever you want to call it, but this sculpture. In the middle of the desert in southeastern Utah. And when we say in the middle of the desert, like, we're not kidding. There's actually somebody who did a little fast forward video of how you actually go get to this thing. And this isn't just like off a beaten path. It's like off many beaten paths. So placed there, obviously by aliens, to be discovered later. And it just obviously has become a subject of just global fascination and fixation. We're on a coronavirus lockdown. I may have contemplated trying to get to Utah to go find it so I could phone home. But do you guys, have you heard the latest? The monolith is gone. Do you know this?
But it appeared in Romania or something, right?
Well, a copycat appeared in Romania, not quite with the same craftsmanship. But no, it is gone. And unlike the provenance of the monolith, we know the identities of the people who took it. So this was just published yesterday. A group of four guys, I guess, that I think I would like describe them as naturalist vigilantes.
Leave no trace.
Yeah, went in and they were, and this was documented by another person who was there, a photographer taking some really beautiful pictures of it, by the way. You should check this out. A guy named Ross Bernards, who took photographs of the monolith in the moonlight. And Ross is there while these four dudes just bust in and tear down the monolith. And then they're saying, leave no trace. This is why you don't leave trash in the desert. Now, their argument being that this monolith was drawing, and this is true, I mean, tens and tens of cars, and I think at one point even an airplane, to this, as I said, extremely remote and pristine part of the desert. Obviously so remote that this monolith has been sitting out there possibly for years and no one found it. And I get the whole Boy Scout thing, leave the place better than you found it. But like, really, you guys are being killjoys. I'm just going to say it. We just need the monolith for a little bit longer for the actual, you know, engineers of it to come down, pick it up, and then, you know, evaporate the planet, which is clearly the plan.
And now you've made those aliens angry. Well done.
And now we're here and we have to wait for the frickin' vaccine. Life is dull again. And no, I was absolutely fascinated by this, but I have to say the ending was just like, damn, man. I mean, that's kind of harsh.
It is. It's harsh.
I wish they just would have like done it quietly and then let it be a mystery. But no, they had to put it on Facebook. Anyway, Tammy, why don't you go next?
Okay, so mine is also sculpture related. Ooh, I didn't realize this podcast. Is totally uncoordinated, people, but we have a theme going.
If you can believe it, we don't plan this out.
They can't believe it.
Amazing.
It's so seamless. Okay, so pandemic sucks, lockdown sucks, and everything is closed here, Noah, the Smithsonian. Aww. After being briefly open, just closed again. So we are stuck with very little to do. But a good friend of mine, through foresight back in August, got tickets online to a wonderful place way out in Potomac, Maryland called Glenstone.
Oh.
This is the vision of a wealthy couple who took over an old horse farm, built some small galleries for work inside, but most of it, it's 5 or 6 acres of cultivated landscape and outdoor sculpture. And so we spent several hours wandering around Glenstone a couple weeks ago, and they have a Koons, Noah, huge, it's like the head of a rocking horse on top of a hillside, and it is entirely made up of living plants. It's wild, like mind-blowing, even if you're not an 8-year-old. and it was probably the most refreshing thing I have done in months because it was all so new and so amazing. And I am so grateful for it. And so I'm going to post a picture of one massive steel structure sited in a meadow. But encourage those of you who are in the Beltway region in the DMV to go get your tickets. Now they are closed again, but when they reopen in the spring, get your tickets to Glenstone.
Susan, why don't you go next?
So mine is not sculpture related, but it is about the evolution of the world over time. I guess I can tie it in that way. Very long time listeners of this podcast will remember a particularly grotesque object lesson that I had from days of yore, in which we had mice in our house and a trap managed to catch 2 mice at the same time, either in a divine act of grace or like a terrible omen of some kind. And now we fast forward, I think like 4 or 5 years at this point. This is going to make us sound like we're like have like filthy and live in squalor. We're actually in a totally different house right now. And once again, there is a mouse. And my daughter claims to have seen it in her room. And one of our rational security listeners deemed the prior object lesson the war on mice. and I recorded my daughter's reaction. She's telling her aunt about what happened. And I think you can really see an evolution in thinking about the applicable international law.
A mouse!
And what happened?
It went so fast in Helen.
And then what? Where did he go?
He went behind everything.
Was he big?
Yeah.
Was he scary?
Yeah.
What did he look like?
He was brown.
Did he have a tail?
Yeah.
Did he look nice or mean?
Mean. He's behind there.
Oh no. What should we do with him?
We could kill him.
Ooh.
Excellent.
So there you go. Her memo on the unable or unwilling ability to capture the mouse and the necessity of killing him is forthcoming.
I think you're raising a future head of the Office of Legal Counsel.
The war on mice takes a sharp right turn.
The look on her face, by the way, is priceless because she is just so deeply satisfied with her conclusion. And she's like, come on, join me. Oh, man. All right,
it's
Ben.
It's the bloodlust, really.
Yeah, exactly. Ben, round us out.
So on In Lieu of Fun the other day, Kate Klonick and I had the great documentary filmmaker Alex Gibney. And this provoked in me a sudden desire to watch lots of documentary films. And so in the spirit of Shane Harris giving film recommendations, I'm going to, over the next few weeks as object lessons, give documentary film recommendations. And the first one, which I watched, it's a three-part documentary, which I watched the other day, is called Don't Fuck with Cats. Oh, and yeah. It is a really cool little movie about some internet nerds who get upset with this guy because he smothers two cats and makes a video of it and posts it on Facebook. And so they start trying to figure out who killed these two kittens, and they end up finding a vicious killer who is called the Butcher of Montreal and is a really famous case in Canada. And it was partially broken by a bunch of internet nerds upset about smothered kittens. It is a pretty cool little movie. It's available on Netflix, and it's called Don't Fuck with Cats, which is a very satisfying name of a movie to say.
I remember that case, and I don't think I could bring myself to watch the movie, but that's fascinating. I didn't know that there were documentary investigators on the case.
It is a good example of when the Montreal Police Department, they had been trying before the murder, these randos from around the world had been trying to alert the Montreal Police Department that they had somebody who was going to escalate and they were going to, something real bad was going to happen. And they were ignored and ignored and ignored. And then he kills somebody and mails his feet to the Canadian Parliament. I mean, it was a real psycho thing.
Wow.
And these guys were like, that's our boy. And so it's a pretty cool story.
I think these filmmakers need to come figure out Susan's mouse situation.
Or at least the film subject, who is now serving life in prison in Canada.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Well, he's probably just better off tucked away over there. He doesn't sound very nice. Oh, but that is the end of the podcast today. No cats were harmed in the making of this podcast. And that's
not that you know of.
Oh, you bring them to me if they were, my friend, because we're going to have
they got pardoned.
There's no pardoning for harm to cats. No, absolutely not. Rational Security, of course, is a production of Lawfare. You can find our show page at lawfareblog.com. You can get your own Rational Security monolith at the Lawfare store, right, Ben?
Oh, we totally need to produce monoliths.
I mean, at least mini ones. Right?
That's like a really tiny good idea. Ones.
I mean, the big one looked a little difficult to make.
It would be, shipping costs would be high.
The shipping costs would be very high, but exactly. If anybody out there wants to make a monolith, you know, let us know. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. Whenever you download the podcast, please leave a rating and review. Remember, you can also find us on Facebook. Audio engineer this week was the great Zachary Frank from Goat Rodeo. Our show is produced and edited, as always, by Jen Patia Howell. Music this week, actually, by Rudy Giuliani. You know, he used to do a drag routine. Do you remember this? Like, remember the commercial he was in drag?
Yeah, he did that.
Yeah, he's revived it, but he's being sued because he chose the name Dolly Parton. And you know, seriously, and on the theme, don't fuck with Dolly Parton.
Okay. Like, I don't like the pun, but she will admire the craftsmanship.
I lovingly worked that one over. Oh, I'm sure Sophia Yan is very happy about that too, because I'm sure she's a huge Dolly Parton fan. And if you're not, you're not American or human. On behalf of my good friends, Ben Wittes, Tamara Kaufman Wittes, Susan Hennessy, and our friend Noah Ephron. Noah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This was great fun. I'm Shane Harris. We will see you guys next week. Enjoy your leftovers. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.